Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us is an old friend, Ken Lovett, Albany bureau chief and columnist for the New York Daily News and its Daily Politics blog. Ken Lovett, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
Hey, Ken, I must tell you how much I'm enjoying your column in the Daily News every Monday, and I think people who want to know what's going on around here are lucky to have you available to them to tell them.
I appreciate it. We're trying to give an alternative, I guess, to what's out there and trying to give an insight to what's going on behind the scenes.
So let's start for the race by the Democrats for the Senate. We have just seen Andrew Cuomo refusing to do what he said he would do during the campaign and to veto any bill which did not include an outside group doing the reapportionment. He didn't do it. And a lot of people, including me, think he didn't do it because he wants the Republicans in office as opposed to the Democrats, who are an irascible bunch of people who are engaging in what we sometimes call a circular firing squad. But on the other hand, Obama now comes along as the presidential candidate. A lot of Democrats are going to turn out who ordinarily wouldn't. And that could, of course, cause the Democrats to retake the state Senate. What do you think?
It certainly could. Numerically, the possibility's there. But as always seems to be the case with the Senate Democrats, there's a lot of caveats. And in this case, it's the four members of what's known as the Independent Democratic Caucus. These are four dissidents, breakaway members who left the caucus, the Democratic Caucus. And basically, they've sided a lot with the Republicans over the last 2 years. They've gotten committee chairmanships. Question is, what are they going to do? They have made it clear they would not support the current leadership if the Democrats take over the Senate. John Sampson is the minority leader. And even Michael Giannaris, who is heading up the campaign effort for the Senate Dems, they said they would not support him as a majority leader. So then it brings into question what would happen. Would they somehow strike a deal and come back? Or would they strike a deal with the Republicans where one of these four members becomes the leader, and then they do a bipartisan coalition that runs the Senate. So yes, it could cause quite a lot of havoc.
That's very interesting what you just said. So you mean to say one of the Democrats could do a bipartisan coalition with the Republicans, and the Democrat could be the head of the Republican Independent Democratic group?
Right, where basically maybe you have the name I hear is David Valesky from Syracuse. Maybe he becomes the Senate president, and then you have Dean Skelos or whoever who's a Republican as the majority leader, or however they work it out. But basically, the Independent Democrat would be the head, but they would form a coalition with the Republicans. And the thinking is, if that did ultimately happen, you would see more defections from the regular Democratic caucus because, you know, you would see Democrats who want committee chairmanships because they carry stipends. It would ensure their bills get passed. So you would probably perhaps see some defections if that did occur.
And you're the insider, the ultimate insider. So what are you hearing? Is there a possibility that that could happen?
Oh, I definitely think it's a possibility. I think, you know, first of all, I think it is going to be a heavy lift to pick up the three seats the Democrats need to even get the numerical majority. Mm-hmm. Before any of that happens, they need three seats to give them the majority.
But Ken Lovett, that is so fascinating. Let's say I'm a guy named Jeff Klein from the Bronx, and he's
interesting choice.
Yeah, well, he's one of those guys.
Yes.
He's one of the four. And he's elected because, you know, if you're a Democrat in the Bronx, you know, you have a shot. If you're a Republican, you really don't. So he gets elected, and he says, I'm going to side with the Republicans. Don't the Democrats in the Bronx take it out on you?
You would think, and we've seen that before. There was Olga Mendez down in the city. There was,
she switched parties. She
switched to sit with the Republicans, and then she lost but she also ran as a Democrat, and she lost the next election. You had Nancy Lorraine Hoffman in the Syracuse area who did that. She was a Democrat. She switched to Republican. She ended up losing. So, you know, there is precedent. However, depending on how they set it up, if they're still bringing home things, you know, money and being able to pass bills, if they are working with the Democrats, if they don't take a far extreme agenda type stance on positions, then perhaps they could survive. But, you know, that would be uncharted territory where you'd have a coalition government.
You know, these Democrats in the state Senate, I often wonder about them. You know, you get somebody like Liz Krueger. Now, Liz Krueger is the best of the group. There's no two ways about it. This is Alan Chartok speaking. There's no two ways about it. She's selfless. She's self-effacing. She would make a splendid leader of the Senate. Every time I talk to her, she says, no, I'm not interested in leadership. In the meantime, there's always this small clique. Now, somebody told me, I don't quite get what they meant. Maybe you could explain it to me, that this whole thing is all about race. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I was going to bring that up as you were saying, talking about Liz Krueger. There is a sense that it would be very difficult for a lawmaker who is white to become the leader again for the Senate Dems, to become the majority or minority leader. Really, it had always been a white leader up until David Paterson became the minority leader. He became the first Senate black minority leader. He was followed by Malcolm Smith, who was followed by John Sampson. So, you know, it's almost, is it seen now as it's got to be a minority seat? That's the question.
The leadership.
Yeah. There are those who think that if anyone has a chance to break that cycle, it will be Mike Gianaris. If they can win back the majority, he can lay claim to doing that.
He's collecting the money.
He's in charge of the strategy. So if they do take it.
And he's extraordinarily bright.
He's bright. He's ambitious. Yeah. He's got a good relationship with the governor. Which a lot of members in the Senate Dems do not. So you can make that argument, but the question is, will there be factions that oppose that just on the issue of race?
Could somebody like Andrew Cuomo make a difference? We know that George Pataki did a Saturday Night Surprise and got Joe Bruno into office over Ralph Marino. Does this governor have the power to do that with the Senate Democrats?
Well, certainly if his numbers stay up, maybe. You know, David Paterson sort of tried, but they didn't respect him enough, I think.
And he had been their leader.
But I think it was Kevin Parker who referred to him as a coke-sniffing, staff-banging governor. Now, can you imagine someone saying that about Andrew Cuomo?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it would be a far different situation. No, certainly he has the power to if he wants to get involved in that in those politics. I think he might have to if he sees that there's enough chaos that it's going to torpedo whatever agenda he has next year. You might very well see him get, you know, try to broker a deal behind the scenes. You know, Rockefeller did it back in the 60s.
You're right. Rockefeller did it. Now, Rockefeller used to walk onto the floor. He was that powerful. And one time there were a couple of people who betrayed him among the Republican ranks, and they were removed as committee chairman. He had that kind of power. I don't think we see that with governors now.
No, but this is as close as you get. He talks to them on the phone all the time individually. He has them out to the mansion. It's really an old school style that we hadn't seen in a lot of years. He's trying to develop that relationship, and he also lets them know when he's displeased. He could do it by berating them, or he could do it even just by jabbing at them. But he lets them know. There's been times where someone says something on television about him, and he'll just bring it up casually in the conversation and put them on the defensive.
Let's talk a little bit about Andrew Cuomo right now. Mm-hmm. He is, of course, a micromanager, isn't he?
No doubt.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, it means he's got his hands in everything. I mean, there, you know, the feeling is no press release, no, you know, major issue is done without the governor's involvement, which could be a good or a bad thing. After the years we saw of David Paterson's detachment, Pataki's detachment, you know, Spitzer wasn't here long enough. You know, in that regard, it's refreshing, but certainly. It could bog things down, or it could be, you know, he can overthink things sometimes.
There's an old joke around Albany that the most dangerous place to be is anywhere between Chuck Schumer and a microphone. Schumer likes to talk a lot. Now, I think that's wrong. I think the most dangerous place to be is to be the press secretary to Governor Cuomo.
Yeah, I mean, they do not say anything without his signing off. You know, when there's a quote, he's signed off on it. He works his people hard. He is, you know, it's a volatile place to work. It's not an easy place to work. I think it's more political than, you know, I mentioned Spitzer. I think Spitzer's people were more idealistic. They believed in the causes. I think Cuomo's people believe in Cuomo.
And that, I think, comes from the governor. I mean, you know, this is all about getting to the next step and surviving. Can't blame any politician for that.
Not at all.
But do you see any difference between Cuomo and his father? That's obvious to you. I mean, without putting you on the spot, I must say that I thought Papa Cuomo was more philosophical than Junior Cuomo.
I think, you know, because his father was a three-term governor, because they have very similar voices and speaking styles in terms of their oration, I think people tend to compare them very closely. But I have made the argument that he is more like his former boss, Bill Clinton, than he is his father. He's more of a political pragmatist. He's more of a centrist. Mario Cuomo was much more liberal, progressive in today's terms. Mm-hmm. And I think that Andrew Cuomo is more willing to try and govern not only from the center, but to compromise and bring the other side in just to get stuff done. That was very much Bill Clinton's style. I think he learned a lot at the feet of Bill Clinton. And I think governing-wise, that's more his style than Mario.
Into all of this come the 2012 elections. I always put myself in front of the television on election night as we hear about things. The surprises don't always come at the top of the ticket. Quite frequently, the fallout comes from Republican congressmen who were supposed to win or Democrat and don't, or United States senators' seats. How important is it that a lot of people, you know, Democrats don't vote like Republicans do? You got a lot more Republicans voting. I have a feeling that has to do with socioeconomic status and education and all the rest of it. But what happens here if a huge group of Democrats come out to vote who don't usually vote and they come out to vote for the president?
Well, then the question is, do they go down the ticket? And that would help the Senate. If you have an overwhelming amount of Democrats coming out, then certainly, you know, the only real, well, there's two things. I mean, we're focusing on a state level of the state Senate, and that could impact it because it is so close. And there are a select few races that could turn it. And then you also got to, you can't forget that the Democrats are trying to recapture the House of Representatives. And they took a beating in New York 2 years ago. They lost six seats, the most in the country.
Right. How many of those do we think are achievable?
Depends who you ask. You know, if you talk to the Republicans, they're going to pick up seats. But certainly the Democrats feel they have to win, you know, a number of those seats back and to be viable on the national scene. If they have a showing like they did 2 years ago, and don't forget, if they have a showing that they did 2 years ago, then they are not taking back the House nationally.
What's your prediction? Do they take back the House nationally?
I don't think they will.
I don't either. No. But, you know, the power of incumbency is huge. Somebody's an incumbent. Now, there are a couple of districts, Lower Hudson Valley, Sean Patrick Maloney trying to take back the Nan Hayworth seat. Those are iffy because those voters there do something that most people don't. They kick people out with a fair regularity, so you don't know what's going to happen in a district like that. But in most cases, you know, incumbency helps you a great deal. You've had name recognition and all the rest.
I agree. And you know what I think is missing this year that we saw 2 years ago? And there hasn't been much about this, I don't think, but you're missing, the Tea Party was a huge factor, even in New York 2 years ago.
Sure.
And there was a lot of anger, and there was a lot of anti-incumbency anger. Yeah. And even though the economy hasn't improved greatly, I think the Occupy movement, whether you believed in the actual movement itself, but it brought to light almost like a schism, and I think it shifted the argument almost. And you don't hear the anti-incumbency argument as much this year. You don't hear the throw the bums out, the widespread grassroots efforts. We haven't had rallies here by the Tea Party like we did 2 years ago in Albany. So I think that's a difference, and I think you will not see as many incumbents go as a result.
Talk to me a little bit about Long and Gillibrand. Gillibrand is a United States senator. Wendy Long is running against her.
I heard that.
You heard that, and that's funny because most people don't know it. And Long is thought to have no chance at all.
I would subscribe to that theory. I think she's doesn't have a lot of money, although I guess a PAC announced this week, one of those super PACs, that they're going to throw some money toward that race. But, you know, she doesn't have money. She doesn't have name recognition.
Way behind in the polls.
Way behind in the polls, and she's very conservative socially. Mm-hmm. Doesn't, not good things when you're running in Democrat New York.
We know that the comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, who is a particular favorite of mine, and for whatever it's worth, I should not make that announcement, and the governor haven't always gotten along that well.
An understatement, yeah.
Do we know why they don't get along?
It really dates back to the investigation into the Allen Hevesy scandal. And I think the governor's people, there were two things. I think they didn't feel that DiNapoli acted quick enough to, you know, make the changes that were needed in light of the scandal. But I also think there was a lot of jockeying. I know there were a lot of jockeying behind the scenes at that time where Cuomo wanted to look like the big reformer. And it was almost like a tit for tat. So I remember at one point, because I wrote a lot about that scandal, Cuomo said something to the effect of, we want to end the middlemen, the placement agents, you know. And the next day, DiNapoli had the power to do that, so he did it. And there was a lot of, like, jockeying on who was cleaning up what and, who gets the credit for it. And I don't think they liked that very much either. Plus, I don't think they liked how they handled the situation overall.
Well, you know, you may think it goes back to that, but I think it goes back even further. I think, in fact, that both Cuomos were for keeping their tickets balanced. You know, one of this, one of that. I remember when Mario Cuomo got elected, Al Del Bello was elected lieutenant governor. And he literally had to resign because Mario was so tough. Mm-hmm. I think this DiNapoli thing smacks of the same kind of thing.
I don't know. I just think they don't have a lot of respect for DiNapoli for whatever reason. I do think their interaction with him was that. And I also think, you know, he was investigating the office and he wasn't about to come out in favor of him. But he went out of his way not to help DiNapoli during the campaign.
Oh, there's no question.
It wasn't a matter of, like, you know, staying above the fray. You know, there were times where he knew that there was very little that there was going to be very little they can hit DiNapoli with, you know, and tar him with the investigation. Yet he kept leaving that out there, that he's part of this investigation, you know, we're looking into him and blah, blah, blah.
And we understand that Shelley Silver got involved in that one. At least I heard somewhere, I think, that he told the governor to cut it out.
Yeah, well, Silver, you know, really was behind DiNapoli being appointed. Silver went to war. And really, that was the end of Elliot Spitzer. The appointment of Tom DiNapoli and Silver's support of him is what ended the relationship with Elliot Spitzer and with the Democrats, with the legislative Democrats. And really, that's why he couldn't survive his prostitution scandal, because he just didn't have the support, Spitzer. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm a big Spitzer fan, but I'm also, because I think he's so bright, but also I'm a big fan of Tom DiNapoli's. Now, the governor has shown no mercy. One of the things he did in his budget, which I thought was really sort of mean-spirited and not nice, was to take away from DiNapoli what we call the pre-audit function. So you want to build a bridge like the Tappan Zee Bridge, and you would have to go to the controller who would review the contract. And the governor's people took it out of the budget, and it passed. And I think the people of New York lost an important protection.
Yeah, that argument's certainly been made, and certainly the comptroller made it forcefully during that debate. However, you know, the governor's people have kind of, with glee, have pointed out that over this Vito Lopez scandal, over whether or not there was a secret deal and what involvement the comptroller's office had.
It was an embarrassment for the comptroller.
And the attorney general. Yeah. But the one thing in there that they did say, they pushed, according to the emails we've seen, they pushed for the pre-audit authority for the for the settlement, and then never raised any questions, you know, about the secrecy of it or any of the other issues.
I'm sorry, Ken, I don't quite get that.
In other words, DiNapoli's office helped with some of the language of the settlement, not about the confidentiality clause.
The payoff, remember, so if you're out there right now, Vito Lopez had a problem with some women in his office.
Sexual harassment, accused four staffers.
And the speaker authorized a certain amount of money to be paid to these women to go away quietly.
Right, two of them actually got a combined $103,000 from the state.
Right.
But as part of the settlement, the total amount and the names of the victims weren't the only things that were kept confidential. The actual existence of the agreement was kept confidential. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the governor's people have pointed out, well, why didn't the comptroller's office or the attorney general's office raise any questions about that? That is kind of out of the ordinary.
I've often referred to the tale of the tailor and seven in one blow. Andrew Cuomo got quite a bit of stuff out of this. The attorney general, with whom he sometimes competes, because Some people think maybe the attorney general shouldn't be there because Andrew was once attorney general, and there's a certain amount of competition there. The comptroller we've already talked about, and the speaker, who he has had not good relations with, and in one blow, he gets three of them on this Vito Lopez thing.
He does, and it doesn't hit him at all, other than there's been a lot of questions about the ethics commission that he pushed for and how they've been operating. So that's been somewhat of a black eye for the governor, because he really is the one who set this up. However, you're right, and now, the governor has a reputation of not playing well in the sandbox, and he doesn't play well with others in the sandbox, and he doesn't want, he doesn't share credit as easily. So, you know, we've seen it with the attorney general. And don't forget, he also knows from experience of being attorney general just how powerful they can be, the AGs. Because don't forget, he was the one who did the Troopergate investigation. That really was the first black eye in Elliot Spitzer. So he knows what an AG can do and how big a thorn an AG can be in the side of a governor. So he's kind of trying to keep Eric Schneiderman at bay and keep him, you know, on the sidelines.
That's a very interesting observation on your part, Ken Lovett. I agree with it. But here is the bete noire for the governor. Once you go into that sandbox, and once you try to dirty your enemies, you give them every impetus to get back at you.
You do. But, you know, as long as his numbers stay at 70%, nobody's going to take him on. And, you know, eventually the feeling is they'll go down and, you know, lawmakers and others will feel more free to, you know, go on the attack. But the governor has been very good. It's, what are we, 22 months in now, and almost 2 years. And his numbers are at 70%, which is extraordinary. He knows that, which is why you don't hear a lot of lawmakers, despite the private grousing. You don't hear them. He's also been very good at dealing with the legislature. And having been here through all of Pataki and, you know, Spitzer and Patterson, I have not seen anyone's adept at that. You know, he really has been able to use the carrot and the stick approach, you know, but he brings them in, he socializes with them, he talks to them, he brings them to the mansion, and then he wraps them when he needs to wrap them, and he, you know, threatens, you know, Moreland Act commissions to investigate the legislature to get what he wants. But he's been very good at that. The other thing he has been good, as much as he doesn't like to share credit with the statewides, he has been good at in negotiations.
Statewides being the controller.
The controller and the AG. When he negotiates, he's been excellent at recognizing something Spitzer didn't do, by the way, that everyone has to leave the table with a victory. So when he brings them in, he knows Shelley Silver has to walk away with something that he could
pay raise for the legislature
coming up, probably. Yeah. You know, and perhaps perhaps minimum wage. You know, the Senate has to walk away with something. So maybe they get tax cuts for the businesses. But he's been very good when he's negotiated these big packages in making sure that everyone can declare some kind of victory while he gets, you know, most of what he wants. So that's been, you know, that's one reason people haven't taken him on as well.
Well, Ken Lovett, I can't say enough about your being here and how wonderful it is to talk to you. The time flies. Our guest on the Capital Connection has been Ken Lovett, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News, Monday columnist for that newspaper, and always learn something from you and from your column. Thanks so much for being here with us, Ken Lovett.
This was great. It was fun.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.